Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter Murray, and this week we are having a special tribute episode to the late, great Christopher Booker. Booker, of course, was the first ever editor of Private Eye. He was a towering figure on the British satirical scene in the 1960s and beyond, and he was Private Eye's longest running contributor ever, putting well over 50 years into jokes and journalism for the magazine. We're going to be hearing from Booker himself later in the episode, as he was interviewed about 10 years ago by Adam McQueen for the official history of Private Eye. But first, here is the magazine's current and third editor, Ian Hislop, talking about just what Booker was like.
Christopher was really quite a serious person who was very funny, which, again, sounds contradictory, but it's fairly good for a satirist. I joined the Eye in the 80s. It was very well established. There was a well-established writing team there, people who'd been at school together or known to each other in the 60s. So it was all very daunting. But I think Christopher essentially viewed my arrival with some amusement and provided I could make him laugh, which I did, and occasionally suggest I knew something about something, which, given that he knew rather a lot about rather a lot of things, more or less made it okay for me to be there. And over the years, I got to know him a lot better, and I very much enjoyed writing with him as part of that team. We ran some tributes in the magazine this week, and Barry Fantoni said, well, it was like going down the pub, and Christopher had said to him, no, it's like a string quartet, which sort of indicated their differences of opinion on it. I always felt it was just like the best writing room, where it was possible for everyone to laugh at themselves and each other and still come up with a joke at the end. So, I mean, he was delightful, and I got to know him pretty well over the years. And the writing changed, and Ingram's left, and Fantoni left, and I still met up with Booker, partly just to enjoy his company as much as anything else. But he still wrote good jokes, and he had a great sense of where the joke was in the news, which is a journalistic ability. It's to spot what's real and funny, not merely surreal or exaggerated or slightly bent. And that was a great gift. Christopher had a great hinterland. So when we were doing a parody of Gordon Brown as a vaguely Stalinist leader, because Christopher had spent all this time in the Soviet Union, he was really good at the rhetoric. He was really good at the language. So a lot of his knowledge just kicked in. He was very good on classical music and opera. We started doing fake opera parodies of Berlusconi, writing terrible operas called The Robber Baron. And again, I mean, act by act, he could give you the plot and the arias. So all that knowledge fed back in, the historical parallels, the biblical parallels. And, you know, he'd been a church warden and wound the clock at his local church. So when we were doing, you know, the parish newsletter from St Albans, Christopher was pretty much on the ball.
And this thing about the writing team that lasts for a long time, it must be one of the longest joke writing teams in British comedy history. I know that things change, but kind of like, you know, the ship of Theseus, where the different parts eventually have all changed, but the team has basically remained the same thing. That has kind of happened here, in effect.
Yes, and I think, you know, as people change and new people come in, they learn what they can from the previous style and add a bit of their own, and it keeps going. But some of the formats are, you know, far too good to drop, and repetition has never been a problem at the Eye. I mean, I picked up a lot of it, and Nick Newman worked with Booker when I wasn't around, and they mostly write about cricket, but they found that pretty easy, and it was an adaptability. And then, you know, obviously things change, and we have different people in now. We have yourself, we have Tom and Nev from Dead Ringers, who work together. But again, they learnt a lot about print, you know, from the original teams, and Colin Swash and Giles Pilbrow, and they're, you know, the cogs change, but essentially the machine goes on.
One thing that I think anyone who's read the stuff in this week's Eye and who read any of the obituaries for Booker will have noticed is the word contrarian cropping up a lot. So lots of things he had opinions on. I'm thinking of Europe, I'm thinking of climate change, asbestos not being as dangerous as everyone else says it is. Huge number of things where he departed from the orthodoxy. And I think these days there's probably a sense in which people are less willing to work with people who have very different views to them, But that seems to have been less the case here, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I mean, any of those things weren't a problem here. I mean, I didn't publish those things. but he was writing about them in The Telegraph and elsewhere. No, I mean, I valued him for what he did write here. And I said on the Today programme, this is in a few quotes, I was sorry he didn't get to hear me say, was that no one ever agreed entirely with Christopher, including Christopher. And that, in a sense, was... part of his appeal. But one of the curious things about Christopher is in his own words, he said he was at the heart of the swinging 60s, and then he gave it all up, and he became the non-swinging 70s, and then the trad 80s, and, you know, it was extraordinary. His funeral, which was, you know, a quintessentially rural Anglican event in a beautiful old church in Somerset where he owned the old rectory, and, you know, he used to look out from his study like some Victorian vicar. He wasn't nicknamed the Deacon by accident. And there was this great funeral, and then in the middle of the order of service, which he meticulously crafted, you know, there were quotes from the Upanishads and the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and you realised he's not quite as down the line as I thought. And that was his life. I mean, he was surprisingly wide-ranging in his sort of interests. And a lot of that he's fed back into the comedy. And that's the bit, obviously, that we focus on, because that's the bit we know about as his colleague.
Just what you said about the Tibetan Book of the Dead there,
yeah.
He wrote a lot about stories and the seven basic plots. He wrote an entire book about the structure underpinning all story and myth.
For years and years, when I came in, Christopher would tell me about this book he was writing, which was essentially about storytelling and how there were a series of basic plots, and for psychological reasons, all successful narratives had these plots. And it's an idea that's been around in English literature for a long time, you know, hundreds of years. And Christopher was going to write this book, and he told me about it so often that I started joking with him that he was basically the Reverend Casaubon in Middlemarch, who was this completely mad vicar who was going to write a book called The Key to All Mythologies. And when he died, all that was found in his desk was scraps of paper with notes, and he'd never written the book at all. Anyway, I like to think that this joke stung Christopher into action, because he actually finished the book, which is terribly good and really interesting. And the thing about Christopher is he was very interested in narrative and in plot, which even for a joke writer is incredibly useful, because you have someone around who knows where the beginning, middle and end of stuff is and more or less how it should go. And that helped greatly.
Ian Hislop. And now, to talk in a little bit more detail about Booker's life and work at the Eye, we go over to the man himself, courtesy of a file that we are calling the Booker Tapes. This is a recording made of Christopher Booker in a very nice Somerset pub garden, taken about 10 years ago. And to explain exactly how Private Eye came into possession of this artifact, over to the Eye's official historian and Street of Shame hack, Adam McQueen.
I, as well as being... I was going to describe myself then as a long-serving hack at Private Eye, but in terms of Booker's length of service, it really isn't. It's a mere 22 years or something. But as well as that, I also wrote the kind of official history of the magazine, Private Eye, the first 50 years and A to Z in 2011. And to put that together, I sat down with a tape recorder with pretty much everyone who was still around who'd been involved in the early days of the magazine. And I went down and met Booker. I'd arranged to interview him at his home at Lytton in Somerset. I drove down there, turned up, and there was this great moment when I rang the doorbell, and suddenly there was this, "Oh, God, that's today!" came from inside. And Christopher, who'd completely forgotten it was supposed to be happening, was nevertheless delighted to see me and incredibly hospitable. And we crossed the road to the pub garden opposite his house, where he recommended the fish pie, which was fantastic. Absolutely, there's probably going to be sounds on this recording of me eating fish pie, for which I can only apologise. So yes, this is a recording of me sitting with Christopher in a pub garden in Somerset in 2008, talking about his career at Private Eye.
Okay, so we'll come on to all of the history of his editorship later, but first of all, he was involved kind of before the magazine was a magazine.
He was. Well, the magazine had its origins at Shrewsbury School in the 1950s, where this bizarre combination of people who would then spend much of the rest of their lives together were in two separate years. So we had Richard Ingrams and Willie Rushton, the cartoonist, and Christopher Booker and Paul Foote, all of whom at various different points worked on the school magazine, The Salopian, and then sort of reconvened in various different combinations in the at the very beginning of the 60s, trying to come up with ideas for a magazine which eventually coalesced into the first edition of Private Eye, which came out on the 25th of October 1961.
Who was in the year above and who was in the year below?
Yes, it all gets very complicated because it was who was a scholarship boy and who did an extra term of preparation for classics at university and all this kind of thing. I believe that Booker and Paul Foote were in the year above and worked on the magazine together as editors.
Okay.
And then Rich and Willie were the year below. But Willie was such a gifted cartoonist from such an early age that that was kind of his contribution to the school magazine and all magazines thereafter.
Okay, so they left school having worked on this magazine.
Yeah.
How long is it before they come up with Private Eye?
So there is university, and Booker goes off to Cambridge, and Richard and Paul go off to Oxford, and Willie goes off to sort of shuffle around a bit and not really know what he wants to do and do a bit of work at a solicitor's before deciding that actually writing cartoons is a much better way to spend your life, quite rightly. But it ended up being essentially a team of two at the core of the very early issues of Private Eye, and that was Booker and Willie Rushton.
And here is Christopher Booker talking about the first magazine and how it was distributed.
My physical memory of it is of sitting in the Richard had a lovely kind of outbuilding with a piano in it, as you'd imagine, at the bottom of his garden or his mother's garden. And it was quite a big, it was sort of playroom. And it was in there that I remember doing quite a lot of the work on this. And then that one, we took it round. Osmond had a little mini. He was the only one that had a car or could drive. And we took it to various coffee bars and restaurants that we patronised. And did we do 600 copies? Yeah, 600 copies, wasn't it, the first edition? Anyway,
I reckon 500, so maybe compromising.
Yeah, I think it was 400. Or maybe it was 400 yellow and 100 white.
So we're going to hear in a second about Booker's own account of how he became editor, but how did he become editor?
He was the man in place, essentially. It was him and Willie were the people that were there and could commit the time to it.
We said, look, this is going to be bloody tricky because Ingrams is elsewhere. So basically it's you and me who've got to do it. I'm interested that in issue 3 it said fortnightly because I couldn't remember quite when this conversation was. But the point of our conversation was if he and I were going to have to do it between us, do almost all the work. We didn't think we could do it once a week. And by the end of our conversation, we were convinced. I thought, well, there must be magazines which come out fortnightly. Of course, there aren't.
There aren't, there
aren't. No. But I do remember Willie and I agreeing that so long as he and I were having to do it between us, that was the most we could manage. And we would get stuck in. And we were going to be paid £10 a week. £10 a fortnight, sorry. That was the prize. That was the reward.
They were paid £10 a fortnight.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, I know...
Outrageously high, isn't it? I mean, that's at least double what we get now.
He was editor for only a couple of years, and he's the person who got Peter Cook involved in the first place.
Yes. A lot of people think Peter Cook was involved in the very earliest days of Private Eye and founded it. He wasn't. He came in later. He went off to do Beyond the Fringe, initially at the Edinburgh Festival, then a run in the West End in London, and then eventually over to New York as well. And it was only when he came back, he said he was bloody pissed off that someone had started Private Eye in his absence, because he'd had exactly that idea of launching a satirical magazine, and here it was already up and running. But he soon got involved later and became the owner and the first, and in many ways only, Lord Gnome.
And here is Christopher Booker talking about his account, certainly, of how Peter Cook got involved.
I go to Cookie and say, how about it? And he said, I'll have to talk about it with Nick Luard, but I think basically we're on. I remember the first issue that Cookie was proprietor was still in Covent Garden. And it was quite funny because we did a quite lengthy parody of The Spectator, which after all was not a hugely best-selling magazine. And the establishment had a big data bank by this time of all its members, thousands of people. And we were going to send, this was Cookie's idea, or probably Blue's, we'd send a free copy of Private Eye to all the establishment members.
The interesting thing is about Booker's years as editor was that the magazine could have been quite different. He was only editor for a couple of years, but we can hear him in a bit saying what he thought the Eye's role was and about his own personal philosophy on it, you know, to be effectively against
all
everything.
The orthodoxies. Yes.
Against all orthodoxies,
yeah,
fighting orthodoxies.
Which was absolutely the way that Christopher remained for the whole of his life, being, contrarian sounds like he didn't actually believe it and he was just doing it out of bloody-mindedness, which there was probably an element of that. But, I mean, he very fervently had his beliefs.
And my idea at that time was that Private Eye should stand for, its basic role was to question all the orthodoxies, all the conventional wisdoms. It didn't matter whether they were left, right. I thought the job is to be totally contrarian and to see the contradictions and absurdities of whatever's fashionable, you know, whether it's high philosophy or low fashion. And just to be holding up a mirror to the caricaturing, the deformities of the time.
The interesting thing about it is the magazine was quite different in those early days. I mean, things like the photo bubbles don't come in until a few issues in. It's very much just jokes until after Booker goes as editor and a man called Claude Coburn, who was a sort of literally ancient hack. He was a man from the 1930s who was recruited by Richard Ingrams to guest edit at the time of the Profumo affair, and then went on to write a regular column every fortnight for the magazine. He sort of introduced the journalistic side, which was then built on by Paul Foote when he finally came to join the magazine full time, and various others who follow in his footsteps. But that vision was there, interestingly, from the very first issue. There's an odd thing on that very first issue in October 1961, which says, coming next week, the Cunarda scandal. And it's promising great revelations about some particular procurement scandal involving ships. And I asked Booker about this when I interviewed him, and he said, well, I knew a little bit about it, but I didn't really know enough. So it's slightly overpromised. Nothing about that ever appeared in the magazine. But that had been the intention right from the beginning. And I know in some of the early days and early discussions about setting up a magazine, I mean, Booker was a journalist. Booker was a full-time journalist of the kind of crew initially. It was only him and Paul Foote who went full-time into journalism. Booker, weirdly, for people who think of him as a very right-wing figure, worked for Liberal News, which was the official paper, weekly paper of the Liberal Party, and was very much committed to that, recruited Willie to that to draw a weekly cartoon as well. But journalism was very, very much his thing from the outset, as well as jokes.
Well, in a sense, then, that's it. That is exactly what Private Eye became.
It is.
But just not as fully, I guess, within his time as editor.
No, although later on he did find himself all contributing to the journalistic side as well. Yeah. He was Muck Spreader, or one of the many iterations of Muck Spreader, in the sort of late 90s and early noughties. He did a lot of that stuff, and he did an enormous special report on the foot and mouth scandal in 2001, which there were sort of editorials in the Daily Telegraph and Country Life at the time. So I'm slightly surprised to see that one of the best investigations into this whole thing and the government's mishandling of that particular crisis had been done by Private Eye, but specifically they were done by Christopher and by Richard North, who was his researcher and co-writer on an awful lot of his journalism and his books later on in life.
So he went on honeymoon, he left the others in charge, saying he'd be back, and when he came back, he found that someone else was editor.
Yes, well, there was a letter that was sent, and again, as I was saying, all those myths of the early days of Private Eye, no one being able to agree about anything. No one's quite prepared to admit to having written the letter themselves.
But what was in the letter?
Although they always have this on it. The word obdurate. Which was Willie Rushton's evidence for the fact that he hadn't been the author of the letter because he didn't know what obdurate meant. Essentially, it said, you are too difficult to work with, which Christopher admitted later on that, you know, there were rows. He was quite... There were difficulties as the team were kind of finding their feet in working together. A lot of it was because of the sort of newfound and slightly too swift success of not just Private Eye, but the whole satire boom of the 1960s. So that was the week that was, which was the kind of televised version of satire. Yeah. And it was very much billed as such. Came onto the BBC in the summer of 1963. They hired Booker as chief scriptwriter. They hired Willie Rushton as a performer. And they hired other cartoonists from the ice, such as Timothy Birdsall, used to do a live cartooning during each episode. And they also tried to hire Richard Ingrams, but there was a very unfortunate episode where he tried to do some script writing with David Frost, who was the main presenter of the show, and Frost insisted on dictating to him while sitting on the toilet and using the toilet. And quite understandably, Richard was so put off by this that he refused to have anything more to do with That Was the Week That Was. And when I interviewed Christopher, I mentioned this to him. He said, oh, yes. He used to do that all the time, Frosty. So there's a little insight for you. So That Was the Week That Was took off in an enormous way. And there were difficulties. It was very, very time demanding. It was also rather better paid than the work at the Eye. And there were some resentments about the amounts of time that were being spent working on that rather than on the magazine. And it all kind of came to a head in that summer of 63. And there was a quite major falling out and this letter sent. And Ingrams took over as editor.
It was a big shock. Mm. I mean, not totally without justification. I thought, hang on, this is my baby. Mm. And they have just hijacked it. And I don't think they're going to do it very well. I mean, it's absolutely adamant. Mm. I didn't like what they'd done while I was away. And I thought, we need to shake the thing up again. And from then on, and I will say this absolutely without fear or favour, I thought the magazine that was produced for the next few months was dire. And the circulation, as you know, went down. It was 90,000 when I left. It went down to 25,000, and they had that massive great crisis in 64, pretty close. And all I could say, watching from afar with a certain amount of schadenfreude, was, I told you so, and if it goes on like this, it doesn't deserve to stay on.
But the amazing thing about this, and this is the thing that a lot of people don't realise, is it's within 2 years, by, I think, June 1965, Booker is back in place. He's doing a page, an entire page to himself to do a profile of someone each week. Which is the new Booker. He's now anti-60s, he's anti-swinging, he's anti pretty much everything. They are fantastically fierce sort of attacks on that whole swinging Carnaby Street scene, of which the Eye and himself had been very much a part a couple of years earlier. But then even more important than that, that's when he rejoins the joke writing team, which by that point has expanded to include Barry Fantoni, and that trio later on expanded to include a young buck called Ian Hislop, who joined in the 1980s, was essentially the key joke writing team at Private Eye for decades to go and continued. I mean, Christopher was still coming in to write jokes with Ian right up until he was too ill to do so at the beginning of this year, 2019.
I mean, it's extraordinary. It's, as you know, the first man involved in Private Eye, pretty much, and then he was writing it was, for 50 years.
I was
years,
trying to do the maths earlier. So Richard Ingrams and Barry Fantoni, although they still contribute bits and pieces, sort of stepped down from the regular joke writing sessions in 2010. Yeah. I guess the next person there is Michael Gillard, who's been writing the Slicker column since 1969. I mean, that's no mean record, but Booker actually genuinely is the person who's been there for most of the 1,500 issues we've done up until now. It's an amazing record.
I mean, it is very sad, but it is quite nice to have the last word about Christopher, because in writing sessions he tended to hold the pen, and he did tend to edit. I mean, even at his funeral, which was sort of meticulously crafted by himself in advance, he put in notes, and his son said that it was all he could do to stop his father actually putting in footnotes for further reading to direct us to what we were meant to think. So in that sense, he usually got the last word, but not in this case. He'll just have to accept some tributes from us.
Ian Hislop, and before him, Adam McQueen, and the much-missed Christopher Booker. That's it for this mini-series of Page 94. We will be back again before too long with more episodes. Until then, the magazine is available in all good newsagents, and this week features a special supplement all about Booker's life and work, with contributions from Barry Fantoni, Richard Ingrams, and other towering figures in the ice history. It's a fantastic read, and extremely well worth the cover price. We'll be back again in a few months for all those of you who have not cancelled your subscription either to the magazine or the podcast. Goodbye.